Good afternoon. Welcome to the Queensland Country Hour. My name's Ali Felton-Taylor. In the next hour, long-time drought in central western Queensland has had some pretty stark outcomes.
A lot of lawns died. I've got no lawn at my place and I don't look like I'm going to replace it in any time soon.
But in the next month, the town of Ilfracombe could be a bit closer to ensuring a guaranteed water supply by installing a temporary desalination plant. We're going to take you to Roma, where more delegates than ever are currently at the Young Beef Producers Forum. I hear they've already had a workout with some aerobics. But how will they take to the idea of running sheep? We'll see how that argument stacks up. And of course, we're going to stay with beef and dig into the importance of cow nutrition whilst the calf is in utero. You know, it makes sense, looking after expectant mums. But first on the Country Hour, the federal government has announced overnight it has raised its complaints with India over sugar export subsidies that many major producers say is illegally dumping the commodity on the global market. A counter-notification has been lodged with the World Trade Organization in Switzerland, setting out Australia's grievances with India's huge $1 billion subsidy program. It's a preliminary step to opening an official dispute with the WTO. And as MSF Sugar's CEO Mike Barry told Tom Major, a strong first step to ending the disastrous slump in global sugar prices.
We're delighted that the government is really pressing ahead. We think it's the right response. I don't think there's any denial that India in breach of the WTO rules in support of the industry that, look, this is a vital industry for regional Queensland and northern New South Wales, and we need this kind of response if we're going to continue to see the investment in the industry in these very important regional townships and economies throughout those areas.
Over a year, Mike Barry, of sustained low sugar prices, what has it meant to a company like MSF's bottom line?
There's no doubt it's excruciating. The sugar price has been below our cost of production, not only from the milling company point of view, but from the grower's point of view. Look, we know the importance, and we've seen it through underinvestment in recent decades. We know the importance of investment in sustaining the assets that we've got, but also in terms of renewing them across the milling organisations throughout Australia. We invest roughly a third of $1 billion in maintenance and another quarter of $1 billion in asset investment. And these are mostly in those regional areas again. So it's a lot of money that flows through these regional economies. So when the sugar price is low, it forces us to think hard about our investment, which is something we don't want to do. We've been investing in our company to modernise and to make us globally cost efficient, to be at the forefront there so that we can sustain low prices. But when prices are below our cost of production because of unfair trade activity, I mean, that just is a really difficult pill to swallow.
In terms of the ongoing costs of that low sugar price, how long will the pain last for MSF and for other Australian milling companies?
I don't know that. We really want to see swift action so that we're back competing on a level playing field. So, you know, look, we're seeing some forecasters saying, you know, 1 to 2 years or more, which we hope we don't have to stomach that pain. And, you know, this is pain directly caused by unfair actions.
MSF, like a number of Australian millers, is part-owned or fully owned by foreign corporations as well. This must be something that's an international issue. What are we hearing from other major exporters of sugar across the world?
They're in exactly the same boat. That, you know, from a Thailand point of view, where our company originates from, yeah, look, they're suffering the same pain. That there's no secret formula to producing sugar at globally cost competitive price. You know, we all operate on the same basics. We all run sugar mills. Some may have lower labour costs, but you know, that, and therefore that forces us in Australia to really look for automation and modernisation of our mills. But roughly, you know, Australia is a very cost competitive producer of exported sugars.
Thinking back to previous actions at the WTO, I'm thinking about the action against the European Union on a similar issue of subsidised production. What is the best case scenario in terms of a speedy resolution to this issue?
We'd really like to see India itself take action themselves. I mean, it's you know, we haven't seen any denial that from anybody that this isn't a contravention of the WTO rules. It seems to be pretty clear cut, and hence Australia's been, appears to be a pretty swift mover here to defend the Australian industry, which is terrific to see. There was a recent issue raised by Brazil against Thailand, and they flagged that. That didn't even go through all the traditional long-winded WTO processes. Thailand jumped on it, they grabbed a hold of it, amended their situation. I guess that's what we'd like to see to happen in India.
That's Mike Barrier, the CEO of MSF Sugar, which owns four Australian sugar mills, speaking there with Tom Major. Meantime, the Australian Sugar Milling Council has praised the combined efforts of the industry to convince the government to take action. CEO David Peach says the severe impact of India's sugar subsidies on the global sugar price was raised with government at the start of the year. He says the sheer weight of evidence provided by growers and millers has prompted the extraordinary action.
There's two main contraventions that the counter-notification lodged by the Australian government alleges. And the Milling Council's work through our economist, David Rinn, has demonstrated that the two areas are, and there's a bit of a Latin here, so bear with me, but de minimis. So essentially, India's entitled to provide up to 10% government support to its industry of total industry value. But what we're seeing is that with the minimum cane prices they pay their producers, that support is around 9 to 10 times that allowable amount under WTO. So there's a clear contravention there. And that leads to the second area of contravention, which is export subsidies. So to get rid of that excess subsidised sugar that India has produced, the government is now mandating and providing significant subsidies to their industry to export that excess sugar onto the world market. And that's having a further depressing impact on what is already an oversupplied sugar market globally.
The Commonwealth has now lodged a counter-notification with the World Trade Organization. So that's one process. Is that the only means by which pressure can be brought to bear on India? Is this the only mechanism available?
Well, what this mechanism is the first formal step in negotiating a suitable outcome. So this will bring the two parties formally together to negotiate over this program. And you know, clearly it would be our hope that this can be resolved through direct negotiation between Australia and India. But irrespective of that, it is a first step. And what's available to us if this remains unresolved is to formally lodge a dispute at the World Trade Organization. And if that's done, we can fully expect other exporting countries around the world to join Australia in taking India to task.
Has there been any indication that India is willing to come to the party?
Oh, certainly they've been a little guarded in their responses. I mean, they've got an election early next year, which is going to cloud their response, I'm certain. And to be really clear here, this is not an attack on India's sugar farmers or their sugar millers, their sugar industry. You know, they're merely responding to perverse incentives that are put in place by their government. So they're just producing as you would expect. What this is a time for Australia to take the lead internationally to challenge this structural flaw that exists in India's industry, because this isn't a one-year thing. You know, this will come every year if it's not challenged and we seek a resolution through WTO.
Is this an uphill battle, though? I mean, this is only the first step. What's still to come?
It's new territory. There's no, for Australia, we rarely bring these cases forward. So certainly that's testament to the depth of the analysis that the Milling Council and DFAT have put forward, that we've even got to this point. And you know, rest assured, we understand that this is a challenging area. You know, trade lawyers get involved. It's a tough, intensive process through WTO, but at least it's a signal that the rest of the world is watching. You know, we have to take action. We've got no choice because our prices currently sit 15 to 20% below cost of production. India's subsidy program is a massive part of that. The forecast exports themselves have been estimated at a damage of around $360 million a year. Over 2 years to the Australian industry. So we really have no choice. We have to take action.
David Peach, he's the CEO of the Australian Sugar Milling Council, speaking there with Jodie Gunders. Well, what do growers make of the big news in Australian sugar? Our far north Queensland reporter, Charlie McKillop, is in cane country today. G'day, Charlie. Tell us where you are and what's happening there today.
Yeah, thanks, Ali. I'm outside the South Johnston Hall and I can see the stacks of the local South Johnston sugar mill working overtime over my shoulder there, trying to get this 2018 crop off. And inside, more than 100 growers and agribusiness and extension types who have all gathered here for the purpose of a coastal innovation roadshow that the Department of Agriculture have put on. So today's all about innovation, but there's no doubt that there has been a bit of a murmur amongst the growers gathered here about the news of the day, the fact that the Australian government has finally decided to up the ante and through the World Trade Organization demand some answers of the Indian government over its $1 billion subsidy program. I'm with Innisfail Cane Growers Chairman Joe Morano. Joe, what's your reaction to this latest development?
Well, I think it's good that eventually the federal government has realised that it is a problem. It's against the World Trade Agreement, and it's about time that they did something about it. I mean, I've been around long enough to know that I've been to meetings with people from DAF, and you know they always want to get Australian free trade agreements and things like that, and they always miss out. So at least they know we're here, and sometimes it takes a while, but eventually, hopefully, common sense will prevail.
Well, it sure does. I think you've been on about this for about a year now. Are you surprised it took so long?
Yeah, I am surprised, but yeah, it is politicians, and it's probably not their highest priority. But you know, sugar industry is probably small and compared to the wheat industry and some of the other industry agricultural industries around Australia. But it's good that they recognise that cane farmers are important, and they're willing to support them.
What is the feeling around the shed meeting that you've been attending today? You had a chance to have a few conversations around the traps?
No, not so much about the World Trade Organization stuff. It's more about what's happening here today. A lot of that stuff, you know, the growers look at it and say, oh, well, someone else has taken care of that for me. And that's the good thing about, you know, agri-political organizations and growers sticking together. So, no one's really asked me about what's happening with India today. It's more about what's happening here.
Sure, and what's happening here is all about innovation designed to try and be more efficient on farm, reduce the amount of nitrogen that you have to put on your crop, and many, many other things that will improve the farming methods used in this part of the world. There is a correlation there, though, isn't there? I mean, you are here along with the rest of your fellow cane growers trying to find ways to be more efficient and more innovative, and yet here you are at the mercy of the vagaries of the world global commodity market.
Yeah, and I suppose a lot of farmers say stick to what they do best, and that's growing cane. And you know, as we've seen here today, I mean, I've said in many circles in the last couple of weeks, this industry was innovated by growers over the last 150 years, and it'll continue to be innovated by growers. And especially when we talk about dissolved inorganic nitrate on the reef, the unfortunate part, it's invisible, and we can't see it. It's not like, use cotton as an example, when they wanted to shut down the cotton industry, everyone could see the planes flying past and spraying endosulfan. DIN, or dissolved inorganic nitrate on the reef, is invisible and it's harder to work with. I mean, if I could see it, then I know my practices by changing my practices, I've made a difference. So that's what a lot of growers struggle with. And, you know, they see what they do and they see what other crops do. So government's got to be fair dinkum. And if they're going to regulate one industry, they need to regulate all industries. Not proposing that I want regulation. I'd rather the government come and talk to us and let's work this out together rather than creating regulation. And, you know, there's better ways of trying to do anything than the carrot and the stick, eh?
But is there a cruel irony that growers like yourself and others are trying to be innovative and more efficient, and yet at the end of the day, the world trading rules still seem to be disregarded at will?
Yes, that's right. And, yeah, something needs to happen. We're not subsidised, along with a few other countries, and we're trying to compete. I mean, I remember when I first came in the industry, we talked about the level playing field, and we all needed to be on the level playing field. Trouble is, we were the only ones playing the game, and we never won on forfeit because, you know, we weren't that much richer than, you know, we weren't as rich as all the other countries that were being subsidised or putting subsidised sugar onto the market. And you see some of the prices, you know, that other farmers, like in India, get paid. I mean, I'd love to get paid that much because it's a lot more than what I get paid. And yeah, so that's why most growers, as I said, haven't talked about it. They're more concentrating on what they can do to grow the best crop possible because, you know, through all this, if you can grow the best possible cane, cheapest possible, that's the best for the grower, and leave that stuff to the experts.
Joe Morano, thank you very much. Speaking of Chris Russo, I think he's about to drive his nitro fertiliser applicator right through our interview spot here, so I better let you get back into the meeting.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks very much, Charlie, indeed. And thanks to Joe Morano. We'll let you get back to the important work of innovation in the sugar industry. 20 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
You are indeed with me on this fine Friday morning. My name's Ali Felton-Taylor. Well, let's head to Roma, where a record number of livestock producers are at a forum specifically for young people in the industry. It's in its 14th year, the Young Beef Producers Forum. It has 240 full delegates taking part, with all states and territories of Australia represented. And this year, they've included sheep producers for the very first time. One speaker, Rabobank's Angus Gidley-Baird, took a look at what consumers of meat want when he spoke with our reporter Nathan Morris.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is the millennials, as I'm terming them, but you know, the 18 to 38 year age group is becoming a big part of that consumer market. Now they're making up about 30% of the total population, probably making up more of the actual expenditure on food. So they've got slightly different pressures. They're looking for slightly different things. They're willing to try new things. They appreciate quality, but at the same time, they're not necessarily wedded and stuck in the same old path for things. So they're willing to experiment, try new things. The ways that we're selling it too is also changing. There's a lot more online sales. We're seeing meal kits. We're seeing more direct producer to consumer. So all those sorts of things, I think, provide a lot of opportunities from a red meat perspective.
Overnight, a new report into the price of beef and sheep was released showing stronger prices are expected next year. What are the factors behind that prediction?
Yeah, so fundamentally here in Australia, things are looking sound for Australian sheep and beef producers. We've got a very limited supply given the number of cattle and sheep we've slaughtered over the last couple of years. So we've got that supply limitation which will support prices here. Plus, global markets are looking pretty good at the moment. There is some pressure in the US with the volume over there, but we've got some strong Asian markets. The US dollar is appreciating against the Australian dollar, so that's helping us competitively on the exchange rate front. And also things like sheep meat market, the US market is actually doing quite well for us. There's some good fundamentals there that actually provide some sound base for it. And then, if we get rain, then producer interest is only going to lift that market further.
Speaking of rain, drought seems to be a common thread in both these markets. What's your perspective on that?
It definitely is, and we've seen slaughter numbers, cattle slaughter year to date's up 10%. We've seen higher sheep and lamb slaughter this year as well, just as people have just had to offload stock because they can't feed them. That has meant that it's going to impact our future production. We're going to see some restricted situations with supply next year, and that's going to support prices. So while it's not great, it's also providing a good floor in prices at the moment, and we can only hope that there's going to be some good rain and that we can actually start to really reap the benefits of these prices.
What sort of price increases are we talking about for cattle?
Oh, that's a good question, the $60 million question everyone would like to see. I don't know. I'm probably a bit more conservative and thinking that we'd probably be overly optimistic if we were looking at price rises that we saw, say, at the end of 2016, but there is the possibility of something like that. We just don't have the supply out there. The only limiting factor is probably what's going on in that US market, and that's probably putting a lid on some of that potential upside to prices just with the competitive forces of other proteins there.
What about sheep?
Yeah, sheep will sheep will actually perform well, and I think where we are at the moment, we used to look at a $6 mark for lambs as being a high point in the season. That's become our average price for the season. I think it's probably going to stay there. We've seen good strong demand out of that US market, and while we've probably now got to the point where the difference between a US retail price and a US imported price and the Australian lamb price, the margins between those have been eroded somewhat, and I don't think there's probably a lot of room to go much higher, but I think where we are, it's probably pretty safe to say we'll stay somewhere in that range.
While the future for the price of sheep looks good, it seems it's due in large part to the diminished flock. And another speaker here today at the Beef Forum is Robert Herman from Mercado. His topic is, should sheep be considered as an option for pastoral zones? Well, on price alone, it has to be considered, doesn't it?
It does, and of course everybody remembers that there were a lot of sheep in the pastoral zones. We're now seeing the flock, the Australian flock in general, at an all-time low, but specifically in these areas, for a whole lot of reasons, which people are well aware of. The sheep flock in these areas are really low. And it's now time to think that a lot of the issues have been addressed, a lot of the challenges are being addressed, and that's an ongoing thing, but you can't deny the fact that the returns from sheep meat and the returns from wool now are as good as we've ever seen.
What about other factors, most of the reasons people have gone out of sheep in the first place? Ease of management, especially with shearing, if you're trying a dual-purpose animal with wild dogs. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, look, and they're the you're right, you hit the nail on the head. They're the reasons that people left the industry. And of course, there was a period of time where the sheep weren't profitable or as profitable as other opportunities. But every industry has to adjust and deal with its challenges. And the challenge of labour, and in the case of this area, the challenge of dogs and feral animals has to be addressed. That's part of it. But what we're saying is that while you're addressing those things, you should also be considering what are the opportunities for sheep and wool, and that's a now thing.
Can you crunch the numbers for me on a per hectare basis?
That'll be an individual situation for everybody, but the things I think that people will focus on and the things that I'm speaking about today are that, you know, sheep produces two products. It produces wool, and wool's a natural, it's renewable, it's very socially acceptable. It's a now product, and you know, the modern consumer is looking for those sort of things, and that's going to continue to maintain demand for the product at a time when we've got low supply. But the really exciting story, I think, Nathan, is that is sheep meat. And the sheep meat story, it begins and will continue to emanate out of Asia. So the Asian tigers are emerging again. Those economies are growing, and that means there's more people who are getting significant disposable incomes. And we know from the past performance of those countries that when they get increased disposable incomes, they decide to spend it on higher protein levels, and a sheep meat is a classic for them. It's a product that can be handled well, it's well enjoyed, and it just fits their lifestyle.
How do you think you're going to go convincing a room full of cattle producers to switch to sheep?
It's a good, yeah, look, I'm probably not going to try and convince them to switch to sheep, but what this group will do, and these are the leaders in agriculture, the young leaders in agriculture, I'm sure what this group will do will consider the option, and that's what business is about. You weigh up the options, you see what your capabilities are, you look at the risks, and you make a decision. And for some people, sheep will stack up, for others it won't. That doesn't matter, because in the end, what we're looking for is profitable, successful agricultural enterprises.
It's all about options. That's Robert Herman from Mercado. We also heard from Angus Gidley-Baird from Rabobank, speaking with our reporter Nathan Morris at the Young Beef Producers Forum in Roma. Plenty of those delegates will no doubt be kicking up their heels at the races this weekend, the Roma Cup, where we hear attendance numbers are expected to be up 27 past 12.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, in the Wagyu industry, marbling, of course, is the big ticket trait, and development begins from conception. That's the advice of John Doyle, the Managing Director of Integrated Animal Production based in Toowoomba. He told Lara Webster, producers need to remember major genetic milestones are developed in utero, not when the calf hits the ground.
The genetic expression of the animal's genetic is totally developed in utero. A limitation of the maternal nutrient intakes will have direct impact on what will that calf will be when it's an adult. Restricting the maternal nutrition of the animal in the last basically 4.5 to 5 months, what happens is you're decreasing muscle cell development, you're decreasing fat deposition, and with that you're also decreasing bone. So you're restricting the genetic potential of the animal. If that animal has been bred to parents of frame score 5, that animal will probably be a frame score 3, because you're reducing the total capacity of not only the muscle, bone, but the organs as well. You're reducing organ size, which is so imperative for the hormonal development of the animal.
And when you say frame scores, for those listeners that are listening and don't understand, what do you mean when you say frame scores?
Frame score is pelvic height for age. There are basically 9 international frame scores, but we measure the animal's pelvic height over the rump anywhere from 5 months to 12 months to, and that determines the size, basically the skeletal size of the animal.
So which nutrients need to be thought about to be put in there, into that cow, so her calf is getting the right nutrients, so what you've got is the best it can be when it hits the ground?
All nutrients. You cannot isolate them individually, But if we have a deficiency of anyone, as I showed in my presentation, if we had a deficiency of trace minerals such as zinc, copper, manganese, we dramatically impacted the actual feed utilization for fat deposition in the dam or in the mother. All of those cows in that pasture had the same amount of ability to eat and metabolize those nutrients, but only in the trace mineral. The cows fed trace minerals, were they able to properly metabolize that energy and store it as fat. So there was an absolute deficiency of those particular trace minerals in that grass.
Feed shortages are an issue, and even without feed shortages in dry times, it can be hard to keep the nutrients up, particularly in spring when cows are ready to calf. I mean, what do people do in those situations to do the best they can?
We have to think seriously of supplementation programs, especially in this, they call it a green drought, and I think it fools you to say, oh, there's plenty of grass. But actually, your mineral content is quite low in your grasses at this time of the year, especially phosphorus and all of your traces are at very low levels. So we do need a mineral lick out there as a minimum if your cow's in an adequate body condition score. We might also need some supplemental protein source as well.
That's John Doyle, the Managing Director of Integrated Animal Production, speaking to Lara Webster. He used that term green drought. We haven't used it a lot yet on the country, but it's certainly the case for a lot of parts. And we will check in with the Bureau very soon. But before we get to them, I'm going to tell you about what's coming up in the next half an hour. It would be easy to assume that the needle sabotage situation was the biggest headache for strawberry growers this year, but we're going to find out that they were already on struggle street with real pressure from overproduction. Also, big birds. We're going to take flight with a shipment of unusually large quails being exported to hit dinner plates in Hong Kong, not as an entree, but perhaps the main meal. That's coming up, so stick around. Time to check in what's making news around the state, though, first of all. It's a very good afternoon to Jodie Gunders.
G'day, Ali. This afternoon, Mount Isa Mine says the city is a safe place for people to live and work, despite it being named the most polluted postcode in the country. The Australian Conservation Foundation has mapped Australia's pollution by postcode for the first time. Australia has reported India to the World Trade Organization over its $1 billion subsidy program. India is accused of flooding the global market with subsidized sugar and pushing down prices. And two people who tried to smuggle drugs and mobile phones into a Brisbane prison using a drone have been sentenced to 18 months jail. More news coming up at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Jodie, the executive producer of the Queensland Country Hour. Well, now it's time to check in with the Bureau of Meteorology. Gabriel Brunesco is on the line to tell us a bit more about it. He's a senior forecaster there. Good afternoon, Gabrielle.
Hello, good afternoon, Alex.
Let's look indeed at the chance of rain, because that's of course a major interest for people all across Queensland, and I'm looking at the forecast for today. It's pretty dismal, nothing more than a millimetre down at the Granite Belt, and then there's only another tiny little patch that's up near the Gulf in the far northwest of the state, so really not really much of a chance of rain. Is that what's the story?
Yes, there is not much today, but the chances were to see some good rainfall increases during the next coming days. Actually, tomorrow, we'll see increasing chances of rainfall, but still over the southeastern parts and extending into the White Bay area. It will be really convective, so you would expect some heavier falls, but pretty localized. Also, with those increasing chances of rain, we are going to see increasing chance of severe storms. So, damaging winds, large hail and heavy rainfall with those. Mainly, the area of concern is eastern parts of Darling Downs and southwestern parts of Southeast District, and also southern parts of White Bay. Not much for the rest. There is still that band of shower and storm activity extending all across from northwestern parts of Queensland into the southeast, but the area of focus is the southeast.
Well, of course, keeping an ear out for that on across ABC Local Radio Queensland will keep you up to date with any severe thunderstorm warnings that happen. Further to that, though, over the weekend, rainfall and, of course, temperatures, what's going to happen there?
Yeah, rainfall-wise, Sunday, that trough is moving slowly west, so we'll see increasing activity further inland, central inland parts. But again, in terms of rainfall, it will be something, but still less than 10 millimeters expected, a little bit more over the Gulf Country and northwest district. And further, next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we'll see increasing chances from the southwest when that trough pushes back to the east. But looks like now the really wet day, Tuesday, Wednesday, especially Wednesday, further, basically the southwestern half of the state, we're going to see really good falls coming in from the southwest, extending into further to the east. It will weaken off by midweek Thursday as it reaches the eastern part, but the southwestern half will see decent falls.
We'll await with hope for that, of course. Yes. Let's quickly check coastal waters, if we could.
Yeah, coastal waters is not too bad today. We still have that ridge extending along the Queensland coast, so winds pretty light to moderate east to northeast. But from late afternoon, early evening, we are looking at a southerly change moving over the southern coastal waters and then extending into the Sunday, into the central coastal waters, reaching Capricornia late in the day Sunday. So looking for those winds to become more southeasterly and freshening up. As I said, from late afternoon, early evening, starting with Gold Coast, and then extending into the other coastal waters, reaching the Capricornia with southeasterly 20-25 knots late Sunday.
Gabriel, thanks for your time.
You're very welcome.
Cheerio. Gabriel Brunesco, he is the senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, 24-1.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It is. You're with me, Ali Felton-Taylor, on this Friday afternoon. Now, maintaining access to drinkable water has long been a gamble for a small drought-affected town in outback Queensland until now. Ilfra Combe, between Barcaldine and Longreach, hopes to firm up its water supply with the introduction of a temporary desalination plant next month. But with rising temperatures and the risk of evaporation, the local council is keeping a close eye on its prospects, as Anita Bole reports.
Despite March rains bringing reprieve to Ilfra Combe early this year, water levels have again fallen to critical. Mayor of Longreach Regional Council, Ed Warren, says while high temperatures are common in the region, a lack of consistent rain has pushed the town to the brink one too many times.
Yeah, well, particularly Longreach Regional Council area, you know, and the towns of Longreach, Ilfra Combe, Isisford and Yarraka are dependent on dam water. And in some of those cases, particularly Ilfra Combe, we've only got 3.5 months' worth of water left in our dams. And the higher the temperature, you know, the evaporation rises. So, you know, it is a concern. You know, the relative water restrictions have been imposed as levels drop.
But the issue of dwindling water supplies isn't the first for the small outback town. In 2015, thousands of litres of water were carted from neighbouring towns as water supplies nearly turned to dust. Longreach Regional Council's Ilfra Combe branch manager Wes Irwin says all the water was pumped from the Murray McMillan Dam into the Shannon Dam to stop evaporation, a similar situation to now.
The records so far in the last few years, I wouldn't like to be relying on any rain any time soon. So the fire brigade, a couple of boys down there got fairly industrious and they used to pump water up in the fire brigade truck and then deliver it into town and into pods. And I think most households had a couple of pods. A lot of lawns died. I've got no lawn at my place and I don't look like I'm going to replace it in any time soon.
Mr. Irwin says while there's no guarantee a temporary desalination plant will be a success, it's likely the best option.
We just got to do it. Yeah, like it's one of those things, if you sit back and say, oh, well, yeah, start looking for negatives, you're not going to get anywhere. So you just got to get in and try and make something happen. And that's what the council's doing at present. So, yeah, I think it'll work. I've seen desalination in another shire that I worked at years ago and it seemed to work all right. So it certainly gets them out of trouble when they need water. And believe me, any water is better than no water.
The temporary desalination plant will be put in place 6 weeks before a purpose-built plant is made and transported to town. It will pump water from a state government-funded bore completed earlier this year.
I think the temporary one will give us a good indication of how it's going to work and where we're going to go. And if it works okay, the other one should be even better along the way. About the only other option we've got is piping water from somewhere, and to get water that's of reasonable quality, you've got to go virtually all the way to Barcaldin or, you know, out the north. So, it's probably our best option.
But Tracy Hatch, who owns the Wellshop pub, says she's not convinced a desalination plant is the only option.
Maybe we need to take a leaf out of Ewenden Shire's book. At the moment, they have a big lake in production. It's certainly a project. So, not only water sustainability, it'll be a tourist attraction, ski, recreation, there's so many things. Bird life, fish, it'll cover so many basins. So I think we need to get out there, have a look and start doing like something there. It's not as if we don't have the acres.
Ms Hatch says the problem appears to be never ending.
So yeah, it just seems like it's just happening time and time again. There's no resolution, nothing seems to be happening. I know they're speaking about the desalination plant, but coming into Christmas, no doubt things will slow down. It'll take time for parts and services to be here and it'll just slow down. I just can't see it happening. The only thing we have on our side is that we're heading into our supposedly wet season, but as years gone by, may not even happen.
She says ongoing drought conditions with no prospect of decent rain are heavily contributing to the decline in population.
We choose to live here. It's an amazing place. We choose to live here, so we just have to deal with what we're dealt. Tourists, they come, they go. They see what's going on, but they don't take it on board, whereas these people that live here have to come home every day, possibly soon, to a dead garden. So, it's very important. So, every bit of water we use certainly gets taken into consideration.
Tracy Hatch, she's the owner of the Wellshot Pub in Ilfracombe, ending that report with Anita Boland. For more on that story, you can catch it on ABC Online and again on the 7pm news tonight. 19 minutes to one.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Western Queensland Channel Country graziers, scientists and traditional owners are in Brisbane urging politicians on both sides of the House to honour their commitment to protect the region. They say the Channel Country's widely recognised ecological, cultural and economic values must be preserved, especially since it's Australia's largest organic farming region. Western Rivers Alliance spokesman Angus Emmett told Hilary Castle they aim to gain guarantees that the area won't be adversely affected by new industries like shale gas mining.
The government running into the election made a commitment that they would strengthen up the legislation with regard to protection of the floodplains and rivers in Western Queensland, and we're very keen for them to honour that election commitment, and we're down here talking to all sides of Parliament and talking about what that protection is and what that protection means and why it's so important for our communities in Western Queensland for the future.
And what are those main concerns that you put forward to the government?
Well, we do have legislation in place for the rivers of Western Queensland, and I'm talking about the systems of the Thompson, Barcoo, Cooper, Georgina and Diamantina and their associated floodplains. The legislation we currently have provides protection against dams, hard rock mining and large-scale irrigation. But one of the developments that's now happening is they're looking at the lower channel country as a place to start shale gas mining. And we're not against shale gas mining, but we really want to keep it out of the actual floodplains and watercourses because they're so important for both traditional owners and they're also very important for the tourism and grazing industries. And we're here for the long term. Those industries are here for the long term. Gas will be here for a little while and then gone. So we're very keen, if it goes ahead, that it's actually kept out of those floodplains and out of those watercourses.
And I understand that one of the main issues is about the impacts of soil and water contamination.
The floodplains of Western Queensland are very, very flat, and it takes very little in the way of putting in roads or pipelines or any infrastructure in there can have a lot of impact on where water flows and doesn't flow. And the other big thing is we've got a huge grazing industry. We've got the Organic Beef Enterprises, which is a massive organic beef operation, lots of different properties involved, and then we've got all the clean green beef by the different pastoral houses and also lots of private beef producers. And any contaminants in that can get into the system, really, even the perception of it can really affect our markets. We're very keen to put protection in place in this term of Parliament. It is a commitment of the current government, and it just protects these areas so that our communities and our people that will be out there for the long term still have these systems intact and fully functional. So what I'm hoping that we can do through this process, it's not about being political with one party or the other. What we really want, the outcome we're looking for, is that all sides of politics accept that this is an important part of Queensland that we need to protect in the future.
Agforce Queensland General President Grant Maudsley says while they support the protection of the Channel Country, further legislation restricts the ability of producers to implement best practice land management and diversify their practice in response to future challenges like climate change.
You just can't ask one section of the community to, you know, it's similar to veg, if you like, in a way, veg management. People that haven't been able to afford to develop carry a really unfair burden for the people that have been able to afford to do it. So it's a fairly similar issue. But water is obviously, you know, protection of rivers is pretty important. You know, it's hard to argue against that you know, aspect of it if it was that black and white, which it's not.
It's a fascinating debate, isn't it? That's Grant Maudsley. He's the General President of Agforce, speaking there with Hilary Castle. Well, there's no doubt about it. It's been a challenging year for Australia's strawberry farmers, even before the cases of strawberry sabotage. Growers are looking for solutions to food waste and oversupply. As Jennifer Nichols discovered, the industry is changing and smaller farms are feeling the squeeze.
Well before the strawberry contamination scare, tons of perfectly good fruit was already being dumped. Queensland growers, who supply the bulk of the nation's fruit over winter and spring, were grappling with a strawberry glut. Adrian Schultz is Vice President of the Queensland Strawberry Growers Association. He and his wife Mandy run what's considered a small strawberry farm with 200,000 plants at Wamuran, north of Brisbane. Working with his parents, they've diversified into native finger limes and herbs. The days of solely relying on strawberries have gone. Costs have risen and returns aren't what they used to be.
We are seeing strawberry farms fail on a yearly basis, and I wouldn't be surprised if there'd be more this year.
The winter season was pretty much perfect in Queensland, with cooler days slowing down production and no major damage from hail or rain. But once temperatures spiked and the plants kicked into full production, the annual glut was amplified by a record number of strawberry plantings. The take-up of new varieties like the Queensland bred Red Rhapsody have increased productivity, but Adrian Schultz says the biggest challenge for the industry is the number of strawberry runners that have been planted.
At the moment, Queensland, I think, has 45 million plants in the ground. So average plant should produce 3 punnets, so that's 130 million punnets that come out of Queensland alone. And we've only got 25 million people in the country, so we either have to look at other solutions, export being one of them, or we're going to have to try and rationalise it as an industry itself, see if we can work out some way to reduce the amount of runners that are actually being grown.
At peak production, with just a few exceptions, supermarkets want perfect, large-sized fruit, and they're the biggest buyers.
What's wrong with some of these? Why are they not being accepted?
The only thing that's wrong with them is the size.
Lower prices and the sheer amount of waste take their toll, financially and emotionally.
Devastated.
Yeah. We've worked really hard. This is a family farm, and Adrian and I have been here with Bob and Joy for the last 15 years. Yep. Adrian works, you know, for 6 months of the year. He goes to work at 6:30 in the morning, comes home at 8:30 at night, 6 days a week. And when you work that hard, you really hope for it to have a positive outcome. The positive outcome has obviously been we've been able to provide a great lifestyle for the kids. But, you know, financially it's been not good. So it feels a bit like, why bother?
But Mandy Schultz has bothered. First, she started freezing and stockpiling some of the strawberries destined to be dumped. Then she launched a Facebook group, Loverberry, Our War on Waste. As word spread, conscientious consumers began backing her campaign, meeting Mandy for what she calls car park parties set up in the suburbs. Other berry farms approached her to sell their surplus fruit.
When I noticed that she was doing these car park events, I was like, what a great way for me and my friends to be able to support a local farmer.
It's stopping waste that we don't even realise is happening as a general. You know, we go to the store, we buy fruit and veg, but we don't realise that the farmers aren't getting what they deserve for their product and how much waste and cost they've incurred to get it to us.
The car park sales expanded to include new suburbs, cities and towns.
This time last year, we thought we were really clever and we were excited. We had 500 people that got involved with our group. Well, you know, because we started helping other farmers, that group has now hit over 5,100, I think it is.
From cooks to charities, brewers and kombucha makers, the war on waste saved tons of fruit from being dumped.
We've had a lot of people help us, but I'm fortunate. You know, my outspokenness has brought a little bit of good and a little bit of conflict, but there's a lot of farms out there who didn't have a waste strategy like we do. So in the big picture, I hope that what we can do enables other small farms of any kind that they can feed into and we can help them as well.
But it's another value-added product that this enterprising mum and dietitian believes has even greater potential. Freeze-dried strawberries.
Crunch with punch. Throw them. They're lovely and crispy, and it's just pure strawberries. I got really fed up with seeing kids eating a lot of artificial colours and flavours, and a lot of the processed strawberry products in our supermarket are actually imported.
Freeze-drying extends the shelf life of the perishable fruit, and it doesn't matter if the berries have been marked by rain. For cooks, strawberry powder is sweet, colourful and preservative-free.
And you can just throw it all over your ice cream, you can put it in your yoghurts. I use mine in my chia puddings. It's just beautiful.
Sounds yum, doesn't it? That's Loverberry's Mandy Schultz. And much bigger strawberry growers are also investing in alternatives to dumping fruit. The full story will be on Landline this Sunday at 12:30. A Somerset poultry farmer is exporting his first shipment of unusually large quails to Hong Kong restaurants today. Duncan Brown from Brisbane Valley Quails earlier this week processed 1,000 birds to be flown out of Brisbane. He says his quails are uniquely larger than normal to make them more attractive as a main meal rather than an entree-sized option.
They're going to Hong Kong, so they'll be gracing some of the menus of some of the top restaurants in Hong Kong, some of the top hotel chains in Hong Kong, so we're very excited. It's been quite a journey to get to that point. I mean, I was at a trade show, the HOFEX trade show, 2 years ago, and we realised there was a real demand for Australian quail, and particularly the large quail. So I guess ours are distinctive because they're probably twice the size of a normal quail. So we realised there was real demand for that, and, you know, 2 years later, we're now at the point where yesterday we processed our first 1,000 quail for Hong Kong, and they will go via Cathay Pacific on Friday.
Out of Brisbane or to Toowoomba?
Out of Brisbane at this stage. We're certainly excited about the Toowoomba possibility.
Were you happy with the product? Does it all lay in front of you in the boxes?
Oh, it looks fantastic. I'm biased. I mean, you get very close to these little birds. And it's a credit to Charlie and Carolyn Scott from the Redgate Farm and the Hunter. So we effectively bought the genetics of them, and for 30 years they've been carefully selecting to have a bigger bird so it can have greater mainstream appeal, because there's a lot of Aussies who love quail but find them a bit diminutive. And so we wanted a quail with scale, is what we say. And that's what we're endeavouring to do.
So not only Aussies want bigger quails on their plates, but obviously international markets do too.
They do, particularly your expat Western markets, and obviously Hong Kong and Singapore, you know, has significant populations of expats. Many of your Asians, your Chinese, still prefer a smaller bird. You know, they love their small, crispy bird. They eat the whole thing.
Yep.
And I think they're open to the bigger bird, but certainly your Western hotel chains, your fine dining restaurants, and in Australia, I guess, you know, we're slowly but surely, I think, repositioning quail as something, you know, you can put on the barbecue on a Friday night.
So when you
don't have to be a master chef to, you know, to conquer it. So.
Okay, I'm keen. Is it the same size as a chook carcass?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look, a normal quail is, you know, roughly 180 grams dressed. So, and normally comes in, say, a frozen packet of six. What we're offering is a butterfly deboned bird that's sort of more around the 300 grams. So a single quail, you don't have to worry about bones, but it's a substantial portion on the plate. And they really are hard to ruin. I mean, I'm a terrible chef by anyone's standards. But these things, yeah, I find they're more forgiving than chook. But a chicken in comparison is obviously, you know, a kilo plus. So
we're still talking about a modest bird.
That's right. Still a smaller bird.
Do they taste like chicken?
It tastes like chicken, but better.
Yeah.
I think. And I'm a chicken grower. I love chicken. Look, it's just, yeah, it's an entry-level game bird. I mean, you go to Asia and they love their game. You know, they love their guinea fowl. They love their squab. The darker, the better. Whereas for Australia, you know, a quail is just a step up from chicken. I mean, chicken will always be a staple on our menus, and it should be. It's such a versatile product. But quail is just that little bit different without being too different. Very juicy. You know, it's got a lovely oil content. It's virtually fat-free. Does a beautiful crispy skin.
Beautiful. Have you found them easy to grow? How's the process been going
easy to grow, yeah. They're probably a more resilient bird than chicken. No hormones, of course, but our birds, you know, they're ready to process at 39 days. And you walk into a barn of quail and they're just, you know, chickens can get a little bit carried away. But quail just look at you, you know, they're really placid creatures. Yeah, very clean and very resilient. So they're a pleasure to grow.
In terms of your output from this point on, the first boxes are going on the plane to go overseas. How often will you be exporting?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. I mean, exporting to Asia sounds easy. It's actually very tough. I mean, it's incredibly competitive over there. And the good thing about this product as opposed to chicken or beef, which obviously has great export traction, is it's completely unique. There is no quail of this size in Asia. So it's nice to be going over with something unique, but then we've got to educate Asians who are used to a small quail that actually there is a big quail on the market. So, no, look, I anticipate there's, you know, it's going to be a bit of time between drinks. You know, we've got a very good distributor over there, and I'll be working with him to get it in front of chefs. And it's the sort of product you've actually got to put it in front of the chef.
Duncan Brown, he's the Managing Director of Brisbane Valley Quails. Let's check livestock markets. We're going to get cracking. Let's go straight to Gracemere. Mick Kingham has the quotes.
A mixed quality yarding of 2,623 cattle were penned at Gracemere, 117 fewer than last sale. With minimal numbers of prime cattle on offer, there were good lines of veeler and yearling steers, along with plainer lines of heifers and cows showing the effects of the prolonged dry season. Cattle were drawn from Hyndon in the west to Nebo to Theodore and local areas. Usual processors, feeder buyers were present, along with two live exporters and opportunity restockers. Good quality veal of steer, the turn of the paddock up to 308 cents, average 276, improving 5 cents on last sale, while suitable weight steers to live export made of 290, and yearling steers to live export sold from 270 to 296 cents a kilo. Yearling steers above 330 kg to feed improved more than 20 cents to average 292, and heavy feeder steers average 286 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers to restockers lifted 6 cents to average 260, and heifers to live export made to 254 cents. Heavy grown steers to slaughter made to 303 cents for the few on offer, and smaller numbers of grown heifers sold to 265 cents. This is Mick Kingham reporting from Gracemere for the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Mick. Straight now to Les Klein, who's having a look at how livestock markets fared this week.
Good afternoon, Arlie. An average quality yarding of 672 cattle in Toowoomba on Monday were flat to maintain last week's quotes in places. Steers and bullocks were in too few numbers to quote. However, heavy cows score 4, reached 255.2 and they averaged 250. Light yearling steers sold to 300.2, with medium steers 313 cents to average 292. Most of the heifers made an isolated 320.2 cents and averaged around 313 cents. In the side yards this week, heavy lambs traded at 678 cents a kilogram carcass weight, with mutton on 427 cents. 6,600 store cattle at Roma on Tuesday were of variable quality. A large lineup of buyers who could afford to be selective were in operation. In the steers, light weaners sold at 318.2, most close to 308 cents. Medium weight weaner steers made to 328.2, the heavier weaners peaking at 326 and sold to 320.2 in pen lots. Medium weaner heifers sold at 286.2, average 268, cows fat score 4, peaked at 253.2. And finally at Derby, bullocks and steers made around 315 cents, and heavy cows to 215, with a few to 259.2. The Queensland Cattle Market Index finished the week on 309.4. That was down 1.8 points for the week. Les Klein in Brisbane reporting for the Country Hour.
Thanks very much, Mr. Klein, and thank you for listening. Thanks to our hard-working reporters from right around the state and, of course, the executive producer of the Country Hour, Jodie Gundas. Have a great weekend. You may be working, you may not, but you can tune in to us again on Monday. Amy Phillips will be back in the saddle from midday. In the meantime, though, you can read more about today's big sugar news online at abc.net.au/rural. It's news time, 1 o'clock.